Well, ladies and...
Hello? Hello?
Here we go.
Do it this way.
Ladies and gentlemen, we switch now to a very important point in our agenda, the keynote address. And so we welcome Ambassador Kurt Volker with us. And Kurt and I both realize that we're the only thing standing between you and lunch. And so that weighs heavily in our minds, and we will romp through the next bit of time so that we can go have our lunch. I think, too, while we are at the keynote section of the agenda, it is, I think, important to, for me at least, to say a congratulations to our hearty band of coalition think tank members who put all this together. This is the fourth of four events. The big job is ahead, which is writing, but to Julie and to Steve, Dan, Esther Brimmer, who's not here, Hans, and to Chuck Berry, and the staffs who have worked as hard as they have, congratulations to all of you all, and it was very good working with you. So give yourselves a hand, well deserved. The title of this of the keynote address, and I'm not sure what if Kurt is going to talk on that title, but it's Launching NATO's Next 60 Years, Where Are We and Where Do We Need to Go? The discussions that we had this morning were excellent, and I think much of what I was going to say, as so many other speakers have said, were discussed this morning. We, the Atlantic Council portion of this coalition, raised a lot of issues concerning Russia, concerning dealing with this idea about there being some concern within the alliance about Article 5 and what does that mean. And so that was discussed today, and I'm not going to get into it. But I do want to just say a couple things, and then we'll turn to Ambassador Volker. First is just to echo Zoltan's very good point about our rhetoric and how we can go about talking about Article 5 and wondering about Article 5 and questioning Article 5 and thereby undercut Article 5. And I think that's an important point to keep in mind, not to say that we shouldn't have self-examination and talk about that, but I think our rhetoric is important, and we'll certainly keep that in mind as we go through our work. But, you know, Dr. Hamry opened up today in a very important way talking about the U.S. election and the fact that NATO didn't come up in the election. And there's some reasons for that, just the way the U.S. electoral process works and what works in an election. And I'm sure in Europe, NATO doesn't necessarily come up in campaigns there either. But General Ralston also asked at a meeting that CSI has held a few months ago. He was talking about what does NATO mean to the United States anymore. And others said, well, what does NATO mean to European nations as well? And I think it is, as we've talked this morning and in the past past events that we've hosted, we've talked about things like capabilities and missions and that type of thing. But one of the things that we are also going to have to answer in our work and that we're going to have to discuss is trying to provide an answer on what does NATO mean to us as allies, and what are our ambitions for the alliance? And this is harder to talk about, but I think that is something that alliance populations, those that think about NATO, are trying to get their minds around. At the end of the day, our paper that we'll be writing and a lot of our discussion has got to focus on this political will. This has come up here already this morning. It's come up in the past, but it's political will that underpins everything that we've talked about, whether it's capabilities or NATO-EU, whatever it is that the change that we have to make or what NATO is here to do, that political will is what shapes it, and we have to tackle that and try to address, particularly to the alliance publics, what we're talking about. I will say that the United States government has not done a very good job on this, and I think other allied nations, too, have struggled with how do you explain NATO and the role of allies in this alliance. We haven't done a very good job at that. And when we do talk about it, it's always done in such a way that it makes sense in a domestic political context, which varies depending on the nation. But it's reached a bit of a crisis point where, certainly within alliance media, there is this question about NATO and seemingly this drift that's going on. I believe there's a lot of tools that we can use to address this. One of them is the strategic concept, and that's why we are so determined that we get into that, because this is an important tool for heads of state and government to use with allied publics. And therefore, as we go about writing this, and I think this will be somewhat in our papers coming up, we have to write the strategic concepts keeping in mind our publics, that they are going to be the ones reading it. I and a number of you took part in the 1999 concept, and we certainly wrote that not for the public, as much as we might have said we did. We wrote that for ourselves as practitioners, which is why it went on for 100 pages and hundreds of paragraphs and into detail that is important for the practitioners, but it is not understood by allied publics, and it helps contribute to this not understanding what NATO is all about. So as we look ahead, and this is, gets to the other part of the speech that Kurt will be giving, where we need to go. As we look at where we need to go on the strategic concept, we cannot just update the 99 strategic concept. That will not work. And it cannot, in fact, look like the 99 concept at all. The detail is important, but I think that detail can go into ministerial guidance or the CPG or other documents. We have to make sure that this document speaks to the publics and are usable by heads of state to explain why we are in this alliance at all. So I think, Kurt, as we get into your speech, what I would suggest is that where we need to go, frankly, is to lift our eyes a bit from the inbox issues that we talk about, strategic lift and consensus rules and NATO-EU, which are all important and that have all been covered. But we need to lift our eyes above that and talk about how we can address political will and how we can get allies to recommit to each other in such a way that it sticks and it impacts that political will. That is, those are my comments from this morning. And without further ado, I'd like to present to you a friend to all of ours, which I think is almost more important than anything else, Kurt. As the American Perm Rep and a new ambassador, I think what's important to all of us is you've always remained a good, close colleague and friend of ours, and which is why you look upon a very friendly audience. Because of that, I won't go into his bio, but I will say that there is something that was left out of his bio sketch that I think you all need to be aware of before he begins to speak, and that is he also had a Hollywood career that was not mentioned in the bio. The Hollywood career took place when he worked with Madonna, which he probably won't tell you about that because he's certainly a modest guy. But when he was in the embassy in Hungary, which is when I first got to know you in the early 90s, Evita, if you remember the musical Evita, was being filmed in Budapest. And they went to the American embassy looking for stars to fill out some of the slots there. And Kurt, in fact, is in the musical Evita, along with his family, as I remember.
Just me.
Just you. But you're wearing a mustache and a fancy uniform or something. Anyway.
I was an Argentine private.
Well, he was an Argentine private. What I would suggest to you, though, is that you go to Netflix and you get to Evita, look for Kurt. I've done that two or three times. I still can't find you, but I did see your name in the credits.
You have to get the widescreen version because when they went to edit for the narrow version, they knew what to edit.
Well, without further ado, it's my great pleasure to present Ambassador Kurt Volker.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. Thank you for that rousing introduction as well. I appreciate it. I think if you want to get a strategic concept that publics are going to pay attention to, I think you're going to need a YouTube version. And you should probably start talks with Paris Hilton's agent now.
Or Madonna. You know Madonna. Madonna. So
something that to get people to focus on this. This is not bread and butter stuff for most people in their daily lives, and it's not going to be. But it's important. It's very important. And I think that for those of us who do this for a living, we've got to do a good job at it. It really is a pleasure to see so many friends here. I just look around the audience and all of these friends of mine who are sitting here, and I think, haven't you heard enough from me already? I mean, is there something different you're expecting here? But I will try not to disappoint, at least, and go through what you probably are expecting. And I guess the other reference you made was to the campaign, the political campaigns, which the best moment in the campaign for me was when Tina Fey was doing Sarah Palin, and she said, "I can see Russia from my house." And that's what made her qualified to be running for vice president. Well, that's what makes me qualified to be the NATO ambassador as well, because I can see the German embassy from my house. It's true.
It's true. You do. Right across the street.
I could see it.
We put up curtains since then. The questions that are in the title here are the right questions, which is where are we and where are we going? And where we are is that we have an alliance that has been in transition for a long time. It has done some remarkable things. There are some divisions within NATO. But I think we also have a lot of reason for optimism about where we are headed as an alliance, including seeing NATO be, I'd say, reinvigorated again. And so, Nick, you can Nick Whitney's here. You can take my entire speech as a rebuttal of your column today. Mm-hmm. First thing I would say is, and just to give you a flavor of where we are at the moment, we had a foreign ministers meeting last week. Secretary Rice was there. We had the usual cast of foreign ministers from all the countries. And a lot of people who took part in this said it was one of the more difficult ones we've had in a while. And maybe not ever, but certainly a difficult one. Hard to get this right. And it's interesting because it's also true that it's the first foreign ministers meeting in a very long time where issues about Europe's East were in the forefront. Most of the recent foreign ministers meetings that we've had, it's been Afghanistan, it's been the Balkans, it's been other things. It's the first one that has really put Europe's East at the forefront in a foreign minister's discussion again. And I think that is one of the reasons why it was so difficult. And what we had for a very long time, throughout the Cold War, throughout the 90s, even well into the 2000s, we had a pretty solid strategic consensus, I'd say, among the allies. How do we understand the issues as they affect us? And this was a Russia that was changing and transforming. We had Yeltsin's Russia. We had a Russia that was reforming, that espoused the same goals in terms of values and direction of democracy as NATO did. It was a lot to work with. And what we've seen over the last couple of years, you can start with the Russian invasion in Georgia in August, but you can go back to the Munich Security Conference in February of, 06 or 07, when Putin was there. I think a lot of us were there as well. And that was another benchmark. And you can look at the Russian election, and you can look at the clamping back on democratic structures in Russia. There's a lot been going on in the East. It's not all about Georgia, although that's a part of it. And that put these agendas back onto NATO's burner. I hope we don't overdo it. I hope we don't think this is NATO's whole agenda. Even as I look at it now, I think of it as at best maybe about 40% of what we need to be thinking about, because there's a lot of other things that are more important and more immediate, and especially the operations in Afghanistan and the new kinds of security threats we have to deal with, like terrorism and proliferation and failed states and the consequences of all that. But they were at the forefront, and I think that was one of the reasons it was difficult, because we have not come back to rebuild a sense of a strategic consensus among us on how to handle these issues in the East today. And so for where we're going, that's my number one issue, or maybe my number two issue, I guess, but they're related, is to have a good strategic discussion and thought process within the alliance about Europe's East. Where are we? Where do we need to go with this? How do we get the right balance? And I'll come back to what I think that right balance is in a moment, but I want to review some other things as well. One of the things that people talk about when they talk about Europe's East and NATO is, we haven't been sensitive to Russia's interests, and we're encircling Russia with NATO enlargement. And I just wanted to run through a timeline that I think illustrates a different perspective on that, which is that as NATO was enlarging, by including first Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, then seven others, then two others, we were also transforming NATO away from a focus on the East at the same time. And if you just look at the timelines, it's interesting, because in 95 was when we created the Partnership for Peace, and it's also when NATO had its first engagement, an operational engagement, was in the Balkans in Bosnia. In 97, we invited three countries to join NATO. In 99, NATO intervened in Kosovo to stop ethnic cleansing there. In 2001, NATO invoked Article 5 for the first time, having nothing to do with issues in the East. It had to do with the September 11 attacks in the United States. In 2002, NATO invited seven more countries to join NATO. In 2003, NATO took over the ISAF operation in Afghanistan. In 2004, NATO created the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, bringing a partnership with countries in the broader Middle East region, particularly the Persian Gulf. 2006, we invited two more countries to join NATO, Croatia and Albania, and now we are fully involved in expanding the operation in Afghanistan, active endeavor, airlift of African Union troops to Darfur in the past, dealing with piracy off the coast of Somalia now. So the picture here that I hope people take from this timeline is that while NATO has enlarged, it has been enlarging a community of countries that share the same values, that are building their societies, and that are contributing to common security, and that the security challenges that are most pressing upon us are not ones that are in the Euro-Atlantic area, but really ones that are at a further distance that engage our security. And that's not to say there isn't anything to do in Europe's East. Of course there is. But that's not what has motivated NATO enlargement and has not been the consequence of NATO enlargement. So that is a way of rejecting the idea of encirclement, I guess, that a community that is democratically based and that is building more prosperous societies, that is integrating as a Euro-Atlantic community, makes a good neighborhood. It makes a healthier community. And it's not a zero sum for anybody. And it's actually a good basis for developing relations with Russia as well. So it cannot, should not be seen as being against Russia or Russian interest in any way. It's up to us to make this clear. And certainly I know what the Russian view is, and I know how this is something that they complain about, and they tell a very different narrative about the 90s and the 2000s. But I think we need to be clear about what we did ourselves and why we did it, and have that kind of engagement and demonstration of Russia of our intentions and of our beliefs. Now, coming back to the foreign ministers' meeting that we just had, we didn't have a underlying strong strategic consensus about these issues in Europe's East, and so we faced two difficult questions. The two difficult questions were, what do we do about Ukraine and Georgia and their request to be included in the membership action plan? And the other question was, what do we do with NATO's own relationship with Russia, given that we had suspended the high-level meetings of the NATO-Russia Council following the war in Georgia in August? So we had to come to grips with these two questions. On the first of these, our view going into this was that we don't want a repeat of the kind of division within NATO and the confrontation that we had at the Bucharest summit. I don't think that produced a result that any of us can look back on and say this was the best we could have done. We should have worked better within NATO to avoid that kind of confrontation going in and find a little bit more common ground. I think we all stand by the decisions of Bucharest, and in fact, in the foreign ministers' meeting, that's the first sentence that we said. We reaffirm these and all of their elements, and there are many different elements to that, including that Georgia and Ukraine will become members of NATO, including the statement that MAP is the next step, including the statement that foreign ministers are authorized to take decisions on this. And so this whole package was what we said, yes, we reaffirm, we're not walking away from Bucharest, but we also need to find a way forward from here. What do we do? And our perspective on this was that we see MAP the way we created it. And I was involved in 1999 in developing this for the Washington summit. And so was Dan Hamilton, who I see here as well. This was a means of telling countries that, no, they're not ready for NATO membership. But we're not just going to fold our arms. We're going to reach out and say, we'd like to help you. And we'd like to help you work through a reform process so that you can become a credible candidate for NATO membership in the future. That's what the Membership Action Plan is. It has since had political values and symbols attached to it that go well beyond the idea of just a reform program, that it means something more than that politically. And because of that, we weren't able to use it because, countries aren't ready. Well, in 1999, ready wasn't a question. In 1999, whoever said they wanted to be a member of NATO, we said no. But if you're interested in being a member of NATO, go into this membership action plan and do the work. And that's what we needed for countries like Georgia and Ukraine, to do the work. So if we're going in saying, well, then we ought to be in the map to use it, but others are saying that, no, you can't do that because of the symbols that attaches to it, then our view is that, well, let's put it aside. It was only created as a tool anyway. Let's put it to one side. Let's not take any decisions about the map, and instead figure out how we can work with these countries today. And in the cases of Georgia and Ukraine, we have a NATO-Georgia Commission. We have a NATO-Ukraine Commission. We have all the tools available at NATO anyway, the individual partnership plans, the planning and review process, the staff-to-staff contacts, the ability to have high-level meetings. Let's just use it all and do this in the framework of the NATO-Ukraine and NATO-Georgia Commissions and get out of this situation where we face a crisis every time NATO meets because we're on the spot. Is it MAP or is it not MAP? And so we just put that aside. That, I think, was a very important step to take because it puts the idea of enlargement on the long-term trajectory that it should be on. As these countries, Georgia and Ukraine, have a lot of work to do. We all know that. It's going to take years and years. We shouldn't put ourselves in the position of trying to make some kind of short-term decision about this every time we meet. We should be in a position of working with them on an annual basis through a reform process, as we have done with many other countries in the past. And now we're able to do that in the framework of these commissions. The second issue was on NATO-Russia relations, where we had suspended the high-level meetings of the NATO-Russia Council as a result of the invasion of Georgia, and this was done at a ministerial level in August. And at the same time, many countries made a point that we should not have no relations with Russia. No business as usual does not mean no business. We ought to have a dialogue with Russia. And that's a point on which I think we all agree. So the trick was to find how do we express this in a way that takes us as far as we want to go, but also has some distinction from where we had been in the NATO-Russia Council up until August. And the idea here is that we created the NATO-Russia Council, and again, I was in Practica de Mare in 2002, and we worked very hard on setting this up. It was with very high aspirations. It was the belief that Russia and the U.S. and NATO and the other allies were moving closer together. We were basing a new kind of cooperation on shared principles, shared values, and treating Russia as one of us in a group of 27 in the NATO-Russia Council, and a presumption of partnership and cooperation that we can build on. Well, Russia's own actions over the past couple of years have not been those of a cooperative partner, and they haven't demonstrated a commitment to these principles and values. In fact, we said that in the NATO Foreign Ministers Meeting communique that we just issued, that that's how we assess where we are. That doesn't mean we should not have any dialogue with Russia, but we should put it on a different footing, recognizing that we're in a different place with Russia today than we were in the past. And that footing, that as we defined it so far, is to say that we'll have the Secretary General having contacts at political level with Russia. We'll have informal meetings of the ambassadors with the Russians. We will look at areas where we have a mutual interest, but we are not going straight back to where we were. And we'll take an assessment, and sometime probably the foreign ministers meeting in March is the likely time, although it's not defined and we'll see, we'll have an assessment of where we are in our relationship with Russia, including the future role of the NATO-Russia Council, and deciding where we go from there. I think that was important, too, because we had to have a stable footing of our relationship with Russia, as well as a longer-term way forward on Georgia and Ukraine. This brings me to what I wanted to talk about with the strategic point. You know, when you talk about Europe's East and how we engage here, my perspective is that we've always had several pillars at once. We've had a very strong transatlantic foundation based on shared values, mutual commitment to working together as allies. We've had a very strong commitment to helping the people in the eastern part of Europe who had not yet had the opportunity to develop their societies the way the rest of Europe had, to help them build stronger democracies, to help them build more prosperous economies, and to help them build security and stability in their neighborhood, and using the institutions of the Atlantic community as both an incentive and a means of sustaining that over time. And we've had an outreach to Russia throughout this whole time as well, so that we're trying to build a cooperative relationship with Russia while we pursue a strong transatlantic agenda and a strong outreach to the people in Europe's East. I think it's getting these pieces back together in a way that we are all committed to and we all trust each other and we all see them in some kind of balance. It's going to be the key to getting through this issue in the future as well. I don't think it's accurate, but I think the stereotypes are that some in NATO have a Russia-first policy and some in NATO have a Georgia-Ukraine or a freedom agenda-first policy and provoke Russia. I don't think either of these are accurate, but I don't think we've had the kind of strategic dialogue and meeting of the minds to put together a solid policy for all of the alliance looking ahead. That, I think, is one of the critical things that we need to do. That, I said, is the second most important thing. To me, the most important thing is even broader than that, which is rebuilding a sense of community in the transatlantic community. I think that this has been eroded over a number of years. We can point to a lot of reasons why. Certainly the divisions within Europe and between Europe and the United States over Iraq were probably the most important thing. I think that had a corrosive effect on the solidarity of allies and commitment to working together. But there are other reasons as well. I think climate change and Kyoto, I think Guantanamo, I think differences over the role of military force in crisis management operations, such as in Afghanistan, all things that exist, they're out there, we have differences over them, and we haven't resolved them. So when we get to specific issues, it becomes harder and harder to find a common ground because we don't have a strategic consensus among us. The paper answer to this is what Jim Townsend said, a strategic concept. If we have a strategic concept we all agree on, then we can act on that basis. But to me, the paper is the end of the process. It's the intellectual work to actually build an understanding among all of the allies about the challenges we face, how we view them as a community, and how we need to deal with these as a community. That's the critical part. And that's the work that I think we have to do over the next couple of years and the most important task in front of us. The business then about the eastern part of Europe is related, but it's derivative from that wider sense of community. Where else do we go? That's two. I have three other things on my list of where we have to go. One of them is we have to get Afghanistan right. We have to get Afghanistan on the right track because what happens there really does affect all of us. It affects our societies directly, our security, our well-being. Second, Afghanistan, without our help, will be a failed state again. And we know what happens when that happens for our own security. We also know what happens to the Afghan people, and they suffer the most from this of anyone. So the Afghan people are depending on us to help them complete the building of their society. And we have made progress in Afghanistan, and you can roll out the figures on kids in school and roads that have been built and access to health care. But you can also roll out the figures on the insurgency this year and attacks up 40% over the preceding year and how difficult this is. But because of how essential this is for all of us, I think the only answer is to work harder and get it right. And I think, in part, that means increased contributions across the full spectrum, military as well as civilian. It means better coordination among these things. It means some adjustments to strategy, to say, have we got it right, or are there things we need to adjust to do better? And it's something that I think we all need to do together as well. And I know that the incoming administration has made no secret of the idea that it intends to increase U.S. contributions. I hope that combined with a good dialogue with our allies and an articulation of strategy that we all have confidence in, that it will also result in increased contributions from our allies as well. And if it's not numerically or in terms of troop figures, maybe it's also in terms of creativity, because there are probably ways we can use the resources that are there better, or we might use different kinds of things in a strategy, such as more in the area of police training, or more in the area of quick delivery, reconstruction, and development assistance. But we've got to get Afghanistan right. The fourth issue on my list of where we go from here is the Balkans. We have made so much progress in the Balkans since the 90s in ending ethnic cleansing, seeing countries get on the right track in terms of building their societies, but we're not done yet. We have some risks, both in Kosovo and in Bosnia, and we have work to do to have these come out right. And we can't take our eye off the ball. I think that this is something that's achievable in the near term. I think we can get the Balkans on the right track in the European mainstream in a period of time that we will all see in our current jobs or our next ones. So it's doable, but it's something that we only gets done if we stay focused on that being a priority for NATO. And then fifth is focusing NATO on the challenges of the future. Because, as I said, these things about the East and even Afghanistan are only a part of the wider agenda. The most likely things that will affect our security today and in the future are things that involve non-state actors and non-traditional threats. And that can be terrorism, it can be proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, it can be cyber attacks, it can be energy issues, it can be the consequences of failed states, it can be humanitarian crises to which we need to respond. There's a whole range of other kinds of challenges which are more likely to affect our security than some of these others, as long as we stay focused on them, and are very difficult to figure out how to deal with. And I don't think we've really built a way of working through these at NATO or anywhere, for that matter. We don't have our arms around these sorts of challenges as a community, but we need to get our arms around them. On this point, I would say about NATO as well, NATO is the place where the U.S. and Canada and Europe are all at the same table. We have tremendous support and tremendous hopes for the development of the EU and its security and defense capabilities and its ability to take on things directly. But that doesn't substitute for the U.S. being at the table in a strategic conversation at the same time. So we need both. And we need NATO to be a place where we are able to talk about the full range of things that challenge our security, even recognizing that NATO may not be the place where we take action about them, because it may not be the appropriate instrument. But we've got to have an understanding among allies, where are we and where are we going. So that is my summary of where what the road is. I guess I would also have to say that I'm rather optimistic about it. We have some short-term concerns, and I think they center around the issues of Europe's East and divisions there, and they center around Afghanistan. But we have some fundamental reasons for optimism. And the first of these, and living in Brussels, I can say this now, is the overwhelming enthusiasm within Europe for re-engaging the United States. With a new administration, the opportunity to put some things behind us, there's a great desire to see the U.S. engage with Europe and vice versa. That itself doesn't solve any problems, but it's an opportunity. And it's an opportunity we need to take advantage of to figure out how we, all of us who are the experts in this area, how we can identify the issues the right way, figure out a consensus among ourselves, and do things that have been too hard to do until now to be able to do them now. Another reason for optimism is just the simple fact that France has announced its intention to reintegrate into NATO. Because while France is already doing an awful lot within NATO, including participating in Afghanistan and in Kosovo and other operations, and is already involved in a lot of structures, the psychological impact of having a France that is fully behind NATO and NATO fully welcoming France is an important psychological impact for Europe. And as we go into a 60th anniversary summit, which France will host together with Germany, that is very, very important, and I think a reason for optimism about European approaches to NATO. Another reason for optimism, it's kind of a macabre reason for optimism, but everything that we're talking about in terms of Russia and what we've seen happening there over the past few years, I think it's caused publics to put a premium on unity. When we went through the period from August until December, the buzzword, whether it was at NATO or at the EU, was we need to have unity. We need to stick together. And that sense of commitment to having a common approach is critically important. And I think that that is also something that has been renewed. And then the final reason for optimism, to take it back to Afghanistan, is that I think, in my perception, again, living in Europe, and I know maybe it's different country by country, and Germany may actually have a harder time with this issue than some other countries, but I do think publics know why we're in Afghanistan. I think they know that our security is affected by this. I think they know the Afghan people depend on it. I think they know there are consequences if we are not in Afghanistan and trying to get it right. So I think we have the why down. The idea that people support the mission in principle, I think, is there. What they don't like is the perception that it's failing, the perception that if we throw more at this, how do we know it's going to get any better? Or that there are liabilities that we can't control, like Pakistan, or like the drug trade, or like corruption and a weak government, or any other number of liabilities that are out of control. So what I think that is an opening for, an opportunity, is to focus on the mission and then find more effective and compelling ways to get the job done right. And I think if we do that, we have a basis to build on, even in public thinking in Europe. So those are my reasons why I think we have a few years ahead of some optimism if we do our job well and proceed, I think, to tackle these big issues on the agenda that I outlined. So thank you very much for being patient with me as I walk through my list of my job, and I'm very interested to hear your perspectives about your jobs.
Thank you very much. Let's give Kurt some applause. Now, what I'd like to do is turn my gaze to, put my glasses on first, and turn my gaze to Julie Smith to see how we are on time. Shall we do some Q's and A's? Yep. Great. What I'm going to do is I'm going to bundle these together, and then Kurt, you can answer them, give you a little bit of time to put them together. And the first person I'm going to call on is the man who's been through just about all these ups and downs of NATO and is here with us today, Clarence Jewell.
Thank you, Ambassador. Good to see you. Quick question. It's one thing to sit here and I agree with you that the strategic concept is, when it's finally written, is the end of the process. I think these meetings and seminars have been very helpful, especially making sure that all the allies and the folks that think about these things gather together. And I can't help but believe that when we get down to the point of getting guidance to the folks sitting around the table writing this thing, it's going to be helpful through capitals. But I can't imagine a short and crisp one like Jim Townsend is talking about. I think it's going to be a document that has to provide some guidance to the military. It has to be a very inside the house kind of a document, which is going to be hard for publics to read. In this regard, it seems to me that the declaration that the alliance might write on April 4th is something that is within reach, and even within the time frame that we have, the short time frame with the new administration in the U.S., that might be a good place to really start and actually get the kickoff point for this process. So I'm curious about how you might see the declaration working, and if it's going to work in that direction, or is it just going to be a happy birthday to ourselves?
Well, let's hope it's more than a happy birthday, although it is a happy birthday. I think that the declaration, well, let me turn that around to answer. The issues that we're talking about are actually hard, and they do require some serious thought and some serious putting ourselves together as an alliance. And it's hard to do that in a short, crisp, glib way, just as you said, which means it's going to be hard to do that in a declaration on alliance security. When this was first proposed, and I believe it was a British proposal leading up to the Bucharest summit, the idea was that this would be a precursor or a executive summary of a strategic concept, which we then have to do further work on to flesh out. That's a high level of ambition for what this document would do. I've since heard other people talk about it in different ways. In fact, people citing the Washington summit and saying that, you know, we had the communique, but we also had a declaration, the Washington Declaration, maybe something more like that, that is really more of a political document that sets a few key tones about NATO and the future, but doesn't try to tackle some of these hard issues that we've been outlining. I suppose I think that's more likely. I think in the scheme of it, it's not a birthday card, but it's not as deep as the original idea, and I think that's probably more likely. And the reason I think it's more likely is because it's going to take time to work through some of these other things. It'll take some time to put people together. It'll take time for the administration to get its own people confirmed and in office so that they can deal with these kinds of questions. So I expect this to be a little bit more tone-setting and directional, and then tasking at the summit to launch a process. And I think the first part of the process to be launched ought to be conceptual, like these seminars that you've been doing, so that within NATO itself we have this thinking going on, and we put the drafting off a little bit later after a conceptual process. That's what I think is most likely.
Other questions, please? Leo. And please do identify yourself and what your day job is.
Ambassador, Leo Michel, Institute for National Strategic Studies. Excuse me. There's been, I would say, it looks fairly certain right now that the incoming administration will look at a figure of around 20,000 or so additional U.S. troops, soldiers and Marines, to Afghanistan over the coming year, which changes in an important way the U.S. presence, assuming many, if not all of those troops actually go into the NATO command, not in what's left of Operation Enduring Freedom. From your perspective, what steps might be necessary to make sure that as this buildup takes place, that this isn't actually more and more perceived as the U.S. operation supported by other allies or some other allies, and kind of take on the coalition of the willing dimension that was not so helpful in the past years. Thank you.
Let me go to Muriel, as she's right there in front of you, and I'm sure that's a good follow-up to that. Very good question from Leo. Muriel.
Monsieur l'Ambassadeur, Muriel Demnac, I'm the Deputy Chief of the Policy Planning Staff in Paris. I'm curious to know what your views are on NATO reform. And when I'm asking NATO reform, I'm not asking sharing of responsibilities. That's not, there are no arrière-pensées. What could be expected from the next American administration? Do you think it can be prepared to give the decisive support to those reformist allies that badly need it?
Okay.
Take those two? Okay. Let me take them in reverse order. On the NATO reform set of issues, I've lived through a couple of efforts at NATO reform already. When I was working for Lord Robertson, and then watching the Hofstadter have a run at this, and now they're going through another effort. I saw J.D. Crouch work through the NATO command structure, but now there's a lot of talk about, you know, we still need a lot of reform in the command structure, and the latest reviews that we've done really don't change very much. So it's very, very hard to do this. And it boils down to countries having individual positions which, when added up, don't make for an efficient overall organization. So my own view is the only way we're really going to reform NATO headquarters effectively is if heads of state and government want it to happen, and if they tell the Secretary General, we give you the authority to reform the headquarters and come back to us. But we want you to figure out what the staff structure is that you need and figure out how to deploy the budget resources that you already have as efficiently as possible. Those two things, the people and the money. And you come up with a plan for how to do this as Secretary General. And we can't, as nations, second guess and pull it apart. That is a lot to swallow when you think about it. Every single nation, including ours, has been terrible about this in time, saying we need this job, we need that job, spend more money here, spend more money there, don't move that person. And if we all do that, we never change. And so I think it's going to take a commitment from leaders, and it can only come from leaders, to say it's at a state now where we really have to change. And so we really have to rely on the Secretary General to do it. There's plenty of examples as to what some of the challenges are. I won't run through them all. But just the fact that your defense minister pointed out in London at the ministerial, 17,000 officers in a NATO headquarters structure. That's a lot of people. That's a lot. And so you think about how difficult it is to get 1,000 soldiers, not officers, but soldiers, to Afghanistan, and have 17,000 officers in a NATO headquarters structure. There's something here. So that's one example. That's the command establishment. Another example is finding a way to make the decision-making more efficient. And I'm going to be very careful here not to say anything to call into question the consensus rule. I personally believe consensus rule is the heart of NATO and cannot, should not be touched. But I do think that when you have a consensus that needs to be reached among countries, we ought to be able to bump it up to the level of the NAC if needed in order to resolve something. We ought to have a high priority that countries place on reaching a consensus. We maybe should have a conversation about constructive consensus, that is, creating a culture where countries, if they're not putting their own resources on the line, whether it's people or money, will defer a little bit to those that do, unless it's a critical national security matter for them. But that's a cultural issue and a willingness to do so, not any kind of mandating or changing the decision making. Because fundamentally, I think that the issues that NATO deals with, you know, security, defense, going to war or not, these are things that can only be taken on a national basis by each and every ally, not imposed by NATO on any ally. I see I'm supposed to wrap up so we can go to lunch, so I'll be quick on...
That was to me, not you.
Oh, okay. I'll be quick on Afghanistan. But I think the answer to your question, Leo, is that it's exactly what Jim Jones said in an interview I saw about 10 days ago, where he said we need to add more troops and more capacity to Afghanistan, and we ought to add more U.S. troops. If that's all we do, we won't make much of a difference. And I think that's a good way to frame it up. We have to do that because it's essential to create a sense of public security. But it has to be coupled with a clear understanding of the strategy that we're employing in terms of linkage with civilian reconstruction development efforts, in terms of supporting governance, in terms of working at a local level with local populations, in terms of dealing with the drug strategy, and in terms of having an international community that's committed to the same strategy, so that it's not just the U.S., as you were indicating in your question, but rather one that we are all behind. We did good work in April. We did good work in producing a comprehensive approach for the Bucharest summit. You go back and read that document today, it still sounds pretty good. It still sounds pretty fresh. I don't think we've implemented it well. I don't think we've resourced it well. And I don't think it's perfect, and I think we might want to look at it again and see are there things we should be adjusting. So we're not starting from zero, and when I say we need to have this kind of a solid strategy that unites us on Afghanistan, we've got a basis to work on. But we do need to make sure that as we put a U.S. set of resources against this, that is against a strategy we all agree on, and that's the best way that we can create conditions where it's possible for allies to contribute more as well, which, of course, we'd also like to see.
Kurt, thank you very much. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you for coming and spending some time with us. Are you going to be here for a little while longer? Or?
No, I leave tonight.
Leave tonight. Well, I know there are a couple other questions out there. You've got till tonight to grab Kurt and ask those questions. But on behalf of all of us, thank you so much for being with us.